Thanks for tuning in to the Medevac Podcast, powered by the Robert Irvine Foundation, whose mission is to support and strengthen the physical and mental well-being of our nation's heroes and their families. I'm one of your hosts, David Reed.
And I'm your other host, Christian Myers. Thank you very much for joining us today on the Medevac Podcast. If you're new here, there is a price for the show. You have to share it with a friend or family member if you get something out of today's episode, and you will. Our guest today is Michael Rannigan. He spent 7 years in the Navy as a combat trauma corpsman.
Yes, sir.
All right.
You got it.
I wanted to make sure I got that right. As a combat trauma corpsman, and he is here to speak to us today about some of his events overseas and while in the Navy. So thanks for joining us, Mike.
Hey, man.
Thanks for joining.
Yeah, definitely. Appreciate you guys having me on and look forward to sharing my experience with you guys, and hopefully it lands on some people's ears that can help change the trajectory of their life.
Yeah, definitely.
And I love that it's going to go into one of our favorite topics of continued service, as well as is the amount of work you're doing post-military service as well, which is quite extensive.
I would say so.
Yeah. Well, that's brilliant. So let's dive in from the beginning.
Okay.
And go with the favorite question of what inspired you to join the military?
You know, and I'm very used to that question, as most of us are that have gotten out of the service. Like many of others, I had the upbringing of just a poor childhood.
Sure. Uh-huh.
And so my path in life, it was either jails, institutions, or death. Sure. I chose the institution route, which was the United States Navy. Mm-hmm. But more so to that, in 1991, during Desert Storm, that's what really got me hooked. Right, seeing the news and the Abrams tanks, and just like, oh my gosh, it really excited me as a 10, 11 year old kid that's something that I wanted to be a part of.
Yeah.
And so I ended up in high school going through the ROTC program because I understood that if you did, you could join the military as an E3 or a higher rank. And so I just kind of planned ahead.
Mm.
But most teenagers don't do that.
Yeah, not at all.
But I was a very forward-thinking teenager because of the upbringing that I had. I knew that I had to find something, a new way of life,
sure.
So to speak.
How'd you do in school?
Oh, it was phenomenal.
You did good in school?
Yeah, I was an A student. I was accepted into West Point, the Naval Academy.
Mm-hmm.
Got a lot of scholarship offers to universities. I just chose not to go that route because I knew I didn't have the finances.
Sure.
To be able to go to one of those types of universities.
Mm-hmm.
So I just said, no, I'm just going to join the Navy. Easier, softer way, right?
It was
just,
yeah.
And I just wanted gone.
Guaranteed way.
I just wanted out of the situation.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to paint my childhood like it was some horrible upbringing. It wasn't what I wanted to be as an adult.
Sure. Where did you grow up?
I moved 22 times growing up. None of my family was in the military.
Mm.
I started out in an urban city, Oak Cliff, which is a small suburb of Dallas.
Okay.
Very kind of your ghetto kind of a city. Mm. House was shot up on two different occasions on drive-bys. And so my mother decided to move us to a remote town. Mm. In a little town called Mineral Wells.
Okay.
So very smaller town. So you're going from a very populated school district to a not so populated school district.
Yeah.
Lived there for a handful of years, moved to another town. So it was just this constant moving.
Mm-hmm.
So the military was right up my alley, right?
Yeah.
They're always on the
kind
go. So I was like, I was used to living out of a bag already.
Yeah.
So it just fit for me. And then when I finally graduated Mesquite High School. So that was probably the longest home I lived in, which was about 4 years.
Okay.
And ended up graduating Mesquite High School and then going off and joining the military.
Nice. So you joined right out of high school then?
Right out of high school. Funny story. I was actually supposed to join the Army.
Yeah.
The day the Army recruiter pulled up to my home to take me down to MEPS, I was playing basketball in my driveway, just little old me. And I went to slam dunk on the basketball goal, came down third degree ankle sprain.
Of course.
So I'm being taken to the hospital via my mom. Army recruiter's like, bro, what are you doing?
Yeah.
I was like, I'm sorry, man. Like, my ankle was the size
of
my fist.
Dunk, dude. You had to dunk.
I got to go.
Any opportunity to dunk.
And so I think it was really a God thing because that's when a Navy recruiter showed up at my home, I would say midsummer.
Okay.
And he walked in. He's like, hey, have you ever thought about joining the Navy?
Yeah.
And I was like, no, not really. And he goes, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, I want something in the medical field.
Yeah.
And the Army could not put that in that contract. but the Navy could.
Oh, okay.
So that was one of the reasons.
So you always knew that you were wanting to pursue the medical route.
Yes. My mom was a nurse.
Okay.
And it's just something. And so it's a two-factor. One, my mom was a nurse and she had a servant's heart. But two, it was guaranteed a job if I decided to get out of the military.
Definitely.
Right? Because if I went in and drove tanks.
Yeah. Hard to do on the outside.
Hard to do that on the outside. So yeah. I chose.
That's again, smart.
Forward thinking, right? I'm always trying to think five, six, seven steps ahead. Yeah. Because I needed to figure out what the end result was going to be. Mm-hmm. So I chose a medical field knowing that I could get out and work somewhere in the medical departments. So
that's why Dave became a ranger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Trade skills.
Trade skills.
Trade skills.
So, but you're not a forest ranger.
Yeah. You know, I tell people that because they're like, what's a ranger? I'm like, I guard bears and prevent forest fires.
That's right. Park, just you know, park just call me Old Smokey.
Park ranger. Old Smokey. That's it. You get the hat and everything.
Yeah.
And
should become a game warden. Now, those fools, they got some power.
Oh, God.
But no, thank you.
But yeah, that was my catalyst into the Navy. That was the reasoning why. Mm. And I actually went into the Marine Corps office and asked them if I could be the corpsman. And that's where I learned that the Marines were a department of the Navy and they shared the medical dental with the Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but what they didn't tell me is that not only did I have to go through Navy boot camp, I had to go through a modified Marine Corps boot camp also.
Really?
Really?
Okay.
It's called FMF school, Fleet Marine Force.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is this directly post-naval boot camp, or is this after your...
So it's Navy boot camp, and then A school, mm-hmm. which is core school.
Sure.
That's where you know the basics. And then from there, you were able to go to a C school, and it was either radiology, surgery, whatever their class was. I didn't really want to do any of that, so I went to FMF school, not really knowing what it was about. And when I got there, I was like, it's not really what I thought this was going to be.
Yeah, and how so?
Because it was boot camp all over again, and now I was being trained by Marine Corps drill instructors. And at that time, the cool thing about it, though, it was only Navy corpsmen that went through it. So it wasn't as if we shared it with other Marines. It was strictly Navy corpsmen being trained by the Marine Corps.
Okay.
So we learned everything we needed to know about being a Marine on top of... We had to go through 18 Delta. We had to go through a pig vivarium course. We had to go through these live trauma exercises to prepare for war.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And again, I joined in 99, not knowing what 2001 was going to hold for the world.
So, I mean, by that time, you should have been close to completing your training at that point.
That's
right?
Correct. I landed at my first duty station in September of... 2000.
Okay.
99. Yeah, September of 2000.
Okay. So a year later.
One full year of training before I got to my first unit.
Okay.
Wow. Okay. And then a year later, 9/11 happens.
That is correct.
And what was your experience with that? I mean, it's one of our favorite questions to talk about is like, especially of those who are serving in a capacity. I mean, you go from a non-war tempo to jumping right into something that we were not prepared for in any sense. How is that, seeing that at your unit on the TV?
So, great story. We were actually on a WESPAC, which is the Western Hemisphere cruise that the Navy does.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a six-month deployment.
Okay.
But once we were in Darwin, Australia in September, we were training with the Australian Army. On September the 10th, we were offered libo, or we were able to go out and enjoy the weekend.
Okay.
So we were at a local pub in Darwin, Australia on September 10th, but it was September 11th in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So at 2:00 in the morning, the bartender turned all the lights on, turned all the music off, turned on the television, and said, "Hey, the United States of America has just been attacked." And that was the first time we became privy to the World Trade Center's being...
I have never talked to anyone who was at a bar during 9/11. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, so we were in Australia.
Hmm. How was the reaction from the locals? Because they obviously knew you were Americans.
So it was incredible. It really, really was because the bartender stated, "Hey, everybody that's part of the United States military, you guys need to report back to your ships like now."
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And imagine I mean, the Navy fleet shows up to port. I mean, you're looking at 3,000 people.
Oh, yeah.
That dump into a city. And now imagine wrangling 1,500 of those people that are slightly inebriated.
Yeah.
Now they're pissed off.
Yep.
Right? So now we're wrangling a high emotions and under the influence of alcohol.
Separated from family and home.
Separated from family. Some of my Marines had family in the trade centers at the Pentagon, at Camp David.
Sure.
Right? So some people on the ship had close ties, even lost family members.
Yeah.
And so it was, when I say it's remarkable, this town of Darwin, which is probably the size of New Braunfels.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. San Marcos. That's kind of one of those cities.
Small suburb.
Small suburb, exactly.
Yeah.
Their public transportation opened up at 2 in the morning.
Wow.
People showed up in school buses and loading us up onto the buses and taking us down to the ship.
Wow.
So it was a whole entire city coming together to help transport the United States military to back down to the Navy ships.
Wow. Wow.
And there you just saw lines and lines of people at the payphone.
Sure. Yeah.
If you don't know what a payphone is, look it up.
Read about that in history book once.
Yeah.
And so that's when I made that phone call to my mom and to my girlfriend, now wife. Hey, you guys obviously know what's going on. I'm going to war. I don't know when I'm going to see y'all again.
Sure.
Right? Probably one of the toughest conversations that I've ever had with my mother. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be that guy.
Yeah.
And so we get on the ship. And it's a very somber, high energy vibe, right? You got grown men crying, you got grown men mad, you just this uneasy feeling. And then it's just, you get palpable on this ship.
Absolutely.
Nobody could tell us anything. Nobody knew what was going on. Everything was secret.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were just kind of in the dark. We're just waiting for orders. And we end up cruising to the Indian Ocean off the coast of Pakistan.
Okay.
And we began to cut what's called gator squares. And it's just basically the Navy ships doing circles in the middle of the ocean, waiting on higher up to tell us what to do. But the really cool thing about that was you never really understood how vast the United States Navy is until you look in a 360 and all you see are Navy ships on the Indian Ocean. I just got chills.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, that was like, holy moly, I am on the right side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as far as I could see, left, right, north, south was Navy ships, aircraft flying above, just busy in the middle of an ocean, right? And I was like, wow, this is real. And nobody knew what Marine unit was going to go into Afghanistan first. First and foremost, Afghanistan is a very barren, desolate, right? The terrain is just horrific.
Yeah.
Can't send tanks, you can't send ground troops. So I was attached to a Marine Corps unit called 1st Light Armored Reconnaissance Unit.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much we drove LAV-25s.
Okay.
Eight-wheeled vehicle, 25 Mike turret on the top of the 240 Golf, right? Like, there's some serious firepower behind us.
Yeah.
And it was eight wheels. Mm-hmm. We drive anywhere and everywhere we wanted to go. So we got word November 23rd, Thanksgiving night. Hey, your unit, you guys are getting ready to load up on the LCAC, so we're going to take you into Pakistan.
Introducing Bubs Naturals, a lifestyle brand inspired by the legacy of Navy SEAL Glenn Bub Doherty. Born out of a commitment to adventure, wellness, and giving back, Bubs offers a range of nature-derived nutritional products designed to help you live life to the fullest. From their flagship collagen peptides, packed with over 20 grams of protein per serving, to their functional creamers with MCT oil for sustained energy all day long. Each Bubs product is crafted with care and quality. What sets Bubs apart? Well, with every purchase, Bubs donates 10% of their profits to charity through the Glenn Doherty Memorial Foundation. They support special operators and their families as they transition into civilian life. Join the Bubs community today and fuel your adventures with purpose. Visit BubsNaturals.com to learn more. And be sure to use code MEDEVAC for 20% off your first order. That's MEDEVAC. All capital letters when checking out at bubsnaturals.com.
We're like, all right, good to go. I'm 19.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, I am 19 years old. I'm a lowly E3. And I'm like, all right, let's go. I'm with the world's elite. Yeah. Right? I went to Marine Corps. Like, what could go wrong?
Yeah, sure. How are you feeling at that time? Are you excited? Are you nervous?
I mean, my emotions were probably all over the place.
Sure. Yeah, I can
but
imagine.
But also, so the unique thing about a corpsman is not only are we there to fix you and take care of your illnesses, but we're also a confidant, right?
Yeah.
There's also the fact that I had to talk to some of my Marines about losing loved ones.
Yeah.
Right? How do I get their mindset back? Mm-hmm. How do I get them back into warrior mode?
Yeah.
Right? So there was...
It's a huge, huge point.
And at 19 years old, right? Fortunately, my childhood allowed me to help them.
Sure.
Right? I was I tell people I had PTSD since the day I was born. Yeah. I mean, at the age of six, when you have your home shot up in a drive-by, what's the worst that can happen? And as oddly as it may sound, I felt comfortable at war.
Sure.
Right? I felt comfortable in chaos. It was good order and discipline that made me nervous, right? I'm just waiting for the shit to hit the fan or for something to go haywire. So I was feeling, my emotions were everywhere. I was excited. I was angry. I was scared. I was lonely. You know, even though you're surrounded by all these people, I still felt on the inside lonely. As funny as it may seem, I had a new connection with God, right? Like, all right, God, be real. We're fixing to become homeboys. we're fixing to be battle buddies.
Yeah.
And so to answer that question, it was an emotional roller coaster.
Yeah, sure.
We get on these LCACs. I don't think I have to really explain what those are, but anyways, they're what takes us from the ship to the beach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we are going into Pakistan. Pakistan is not our friend. They don't want us there.
Mm-hmm.
So we are greeted by the Pakistani army. And we're like, oh, we're going to war now. They'll be telling me nothing. I'm an
E3. Yeah.
Well, I don't rate knowledge.
And the thoughts are just racing in your mind about what's happening. Yeah. No one knows anything. They probably know more in the United States as a civilian than you do when you're on the ship.
At this point in time, yes. Yeah. Their lines of comms are open. Our lines of comms are like, we don't know.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay.
Just tell me where to go.
So this point, spray and pray.
Yeah.
So we get into Pakistan. We end up staying at an kind of an abandoned airbase.
Mm-hmm.
What's really unique about the Pakistani army is they ended up surrounding our unit.
Okay.
With their military. And kind of made me nervous.
Yeah. Point of comfort and discomfort at the same time.
So
do they have our backs?
Yeah.
Or do they?
What's really going on? Yeah. And so I didn't really understand that in Pakistan, men are for pleasure, women are for breeding. I didn't know that. And when we were there one evening, you would see this little Toyota Tacomas start making its way through all these tents and dropping off children. And when I say children, I mean boys from the age of like 12 to 16.
Yep.
And they spent the night in these men's tents. Mm-hmm. And all you heard all night long were these screams.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine.
Oh, that's terrible.
We are sitting there having to hear this and we are not allowed to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we're furious. We are angry. We're just like, oh my gosh, who the fuck is allowing this to happen?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Sure.
And we went and talked to the staff sergeant. I was like, hey man, this can't be good. Why aren't we doing anything? And like the government, hey, out of sight, out of mind, not our problem, not our country. Our goal is Osama bin Laden. Our goal is the Taliban, Al Qaeda. That's where our focus needs to be.
Yeah.
And we're like, whatever. Next thing we know, C-17 lands on an airstrip about as long as this table in my brain. Right. And looking again, I'm like, hey, I know I'm lowly guy, but it doesn't look like you have enough runway for this big jumbo plane to get all these LAVs on, right? Because we're loading them up. Mm-hmm. We got about 20 LAVs that we load onto this airplane. And I swear the runway is from where I'm sitting to the end of that table, and all I see is ocean. I'm like, all right, God, back again. Okay, let's go. So we, fortunately, the C-17, I don't know if you guys have ever been on one of these jumbo jets, but they are cool.
Yeah, it's a big airplane.
It's a big airplane, and it takes off, and within 3 seconds, and you're in the air.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, that was incredible.
Skyboats,
yeah. And about a 15-minute flight was what it seemed like. I'm sure it was longer. I probably went to sleep. We land at the mountains of Tora Bora.
Mm-hmm.
There hadn't been many units there prior to us getting there. maybe some special forces guys, maybe the a combat control team was maybe in there.
Yeah.
But we get out, sandstorm hits us, helicopter crashes, gunfight emerges as we are coming out.
All at the same time?
Out of a C-17. Yeah. And it's about 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning.
Okay.
Here's what they didn't tell me, though. And this is where I'm kind of upset with the Marine Corps. Pakistan was 85 degrees. Nobody told me that the mountains of Tora Bora were going to be 32 degrees.
Yeah, quite cold.
So we dropped the hatch. Sleeves are rolled up.
Yeah.
Summer gear's on. We get hit with frost.
Yeah, freezing.
Like, no cold weather gear, right? So we're just like, oh, crap. Do the best we can with what we have, so to speak. And so we were met with several different elements, right? Weather, terrain, Al-Qaeda. Fighting Al-Qaeda was like fighting, what is that stupid arcade where you hit the gopher?
The whack-a-moles,
right? So yeah. That's who we were fighting. We were fighting whack-a-moles, unbeknownst to me, that the country of Afghanistan has over 1 million miles of tunnels throughout their country, right? That's how they live. That's just what they are. And so we were constantly getting pop shots. And so to back up, when we got off of that that C-17, we managed to secure our area. The Marines managed to take care of the Al-Qaeda, and I managed to treat the helicopter that crashed. Fortunately, they didn't sustain like life-threatening injuries.
Okay.
It was just more, they were really good at crashing that helicopter, I can tell you that, because it was a sandstorm.
So what's the background behind that story?
In regards
to the helicopter going down.
So I don't know. We don't even know why the helicopter was there.
Okay.
I assumed that it was part of a special operations group.
Sure.
Or some sort of a combat control mission. Like, we don't know.
Yeah.
We just know that that helicopter went down because we were there.
Was it, did it roll over? Like, crash?
Again,
like,
it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Okay. Yeah. Sandstorm. I can't see from you to me right now.
Okay.
All we're hearing is gunfire, and all I saw was the flash of an explosion.
Okay.
Right. And so once we were able to secure, light was now starting to peak.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So now dawn is happening. Sun's coming out. Now we can figure out what is what. So we were able to gather our bearing.
Okay.
So we were able to get over there. These pilots were well trained. They didn't sustain any life threatening. They were able to take care of themselves. They basically walked out of this crash unscathed. So to me, it looked like they had already dropped who they needed to, and they were just egressing out.
Okay.
Right. And so I think they ended up getting on the C-17 and doing their thing. But again, I'm just that lowly E3 guy.
Yeah.
They're not going to tell me anything in the first place. Even when I started asking questions.
Yeah, but this is day one.
This is day one.
Yeah. And like in the initial invasion.
Yeah, the initial invasion.
Wow.
Which is intense all in itself, because there's, you know, at least after a culmination of years and experience, you could talk to individuals about what it's going to look like when you're there.
You.
Yeah, there is no warning at all. There's no armor at the time. The equipment's lacking. CQB was not what it is today.
Mm-mm.
Like it was all patrol. You know, it was like, how do we push through a woodland terrain?
Yeah.
That was combat.
Foot patrols.
So, yeah, no foot. That was a cool thing with LAVs, right? So we didn't have foot patrols. We did have scouts.
And before IEDs, which was great. I mean, they had IEDs, but like that really picked up in the 2006, 2008 era.
So, funny story.
Okay.
It actually picked up in 2001. So during the Russian-Afghan war, the Russians would fly over Afghanistan and shove crates of C4 explosives that looked like airplanes, cars, toys. And they would just shove them out of the back of these airplanes, and it was littered across Afghanistan.
Yeah.
So there was no way for us to ever even find these IEDs, landmines, or whatever. And I didn't find that out until we went through a little town in Afghanistan where majority of the people were either missing a hand or missing a foot, or maybe just the elbow down. And I just started inquiring. I was like, hey, what gives?
Yeah.
And that's where I found out that these Russians were just cold-hearted SOBs, right? Like, who does that? And so that's why the Afghans are the number one populated country of amputees, because of the Russians.
Mm.
And it was really kind of crazy, because as we drove through these towns, Our enemy were children, were teenagers, were young adults that were missing a hand or missing a foot. And our rules of engagement were don't fire unless fired upon.
Yeah.
Again, in my brain, I'm like,
gotta wait.
Why do you want to wait for me to get shot before we can return fire? But because the Afghan people were raised to have guns on their possession, it was normal. Mm-hmm. So just because somebody had a weapon did not constitute them to be an enemy,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
Because there was a lot of people in Afghanistan that appreciated the U.S. being there, and there was only a handful of the Al-Qaeda Taliban that we were actually looking for.
Mm.
So it was a very kind of dicey game because you didn't know who the enemy was.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Purdue.
Everybody looked the same.
Yep.
And where does
and everybody does have a weapon.
And everybody has a weapon.
Everybody has a weapon. And I'm sure every combat veteran could relate to the, yeah, well, let them shoot first at some point in their career, which right. is just
beside me.
It is. It's awful. I kind of the consensus was, is if you aim your weapon in any intent to fire, then
it's game on.
It's game on.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's standard ROE.
The only benefit to them having a weapon and it didn't heighten our fear was we knew that they were using weaponry from the Russian war.
Mm-hmm.
So we got hit with an RPG, but the RPG was from Russia, right? So it's like 30 years old.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So come to find out an RPG has to rotate so many rounds per second before it actually is able to explode. So it just hit our muffler and put a big dent in it. I'm talking, but the pucker factor was still real.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
That's a close call. That's a thank you Jesus moment there.
Like I said before, like me and God, we got real close.
That is a thank you Jesus moment.
Yeah, we were homeboys. Yeah. You know what I mean? Father, Son, Holy Trinity. We were friends.
Big loud ding.
Yeah. And so it kind of gave us a false sense of security. Right. One, their shooting skills were garbage. Right. It was more of a spray and pray type of mode.
Yeah.
The RPG.
Above your head, just fire and forget.
Yeah.
Fully automatic weapons as well is not the way to do it.
Nah. And so their recoil's all over the place. And so it gave us a little bit of comfort knowing that we were battling people with low level skill sets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But not to be confused that at any given time, that stray round will kill you.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think, unfortunately, that has sandbagged us into thinking that we're big and bad, and as soon as we face a near peer ally,
it's a great point.
We might get our pants pulled down a little bit.
A little bit.
Well, for sure, if you have anyone trained in any sort of CQB tactics, we're going to be in trouble.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, it just takes one.
Yeah. Not to go too far off topic, but it's true. I mean, we were legitimately fighting people who wore crushed water bottles as shoes. Not joking.
Right.
They fought in that.
They fought in that and barefoot. So we weren't fighting like this hierarchy of an enemy, but they were a complicated enemy.
Very much. Absolutely. So. And the guerrilla warfare and tactics as well is hard to fight in general.
The ingenuity.
And it becomes mentally tough for us. Because there's days on days of driving and looking and searching, and you start to get this questioning, why are we here?
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing? Where are these people you spoke about?
Yeah.
Right? We start to second guess what we're really doing.
I think that's very common.
We probably should have done that a little more.
And so we end up, again, starting out in Tora Bora, driving through Afghanistan, like we made up all these names for these camps, Camp Rhino, Camp Anaconda, Camp whatever. Never made real sense to me. Again, I'm the guy at the bottom.
Yeah.
And so I only remember a handful of these names, like the Anbar province and the Hindu Kush and Kandahar and Bagram, right? So those are some of the bigger cities that I can actually recall. Mm-hmm. But we ended up pushing all the way into Kandahar International Airport. So we were the very first units to secure Kandahar International Airport to make way for the Air Force and the Army to come in and show up. We were really satisfied when they did because what we got was cold weather gear.
Yeah, replenishment. We finally,
and this is 4 months in, right, of cruising through, or maybe 2 months in. We'd already spent Christmas. Christmas had gone, come and gone. Mm-hmm. Now we're into January, February. We're finally getting the cold weather gear that we deserve. And we're actually now getting Sasser plates. Like, we didn't even have plates to go into our flak jackets. You know, always everybody always said, yeah, Marines get the garbage in, the Army's leftovers.
Yeah.
And I was like, ah, whatever, that's bullshit. You guys are the few of the proud. Like, why would they sacrifice their stuff on you guys?
Yeah, they're proud to operate on a low budget.
And then I got a part of them, and I was like, damn it, you guys really do get the shit out of this dick.
They do,
But that just makes them, it just made us more...
And then it's like LCEs in the beginning. It's not even, you know, flak jackets or anything.
L vest.
You just got like
full chest open.
Like my Molly
Vietnam edition. Think like, still had the, I mean, you guys were rocking like the BDU.
That's right.
Vest for quite a bit of time.
Yeah. We didn't get, I never even owned a set of digis.
Just, probably 2008. You know,
yeah, I was gone. Yeah. So we wore the Woodlands. We finally got desert camis. So we were there in Woodland.
That's ridiculous.
And we finally desert camo. I'm like, really, guys?
Brought you out in Woodland.
Like, here I am. Yeah, man, whatever. We're like, I just throw some dirt on it.
Yes. The green blends in very, very well with the brown.
Yes. Telling you, man. We were like, but again, we didn't set out on a Westpac to go into Afghanistan. It was nowhere on our radar.
Yeah.
We come to find out it was actually on our radar. We just chose not to look at it. But that's not here. That's not for me to say, right? But sure. Hey, fuck it, whatever. It's 20 years later.
What are they going to do?
Well, we failed so miserably.
Miserably.
On pulling out of that country. Did an absolute disservice to them by just abandoning everything overnight. So, yes, feel free to speak your mind after 20 years.
It's total utter bullshit.
And you know, the crazy thing, too, is that you hear these stories about these, you know, some of these soldiers or boots on the ground that are trying to sabotage their own equipment because they know they're going to abandon it for, you know, the terrorist organizations that are coming in and hijacking these. And you have chain of command that are telling them, don't touch it. That's a federal offense.
What?
So it's just, there is just a huge disconnect with leadership and execution, right? Strategic versus implementation.
Theory of reality too.
Yeah, that's 101.
Technically,
right,
this is illegal. Like, so is giving them all of our shit.
Yeah, and
also illegal.
Doesn't it beg the question that, like, it seems that it was done so intentionally? Like, we've done this, Russia has done this before.
Yeah, we watched this happen.
And here we are, like, don't sabotage it. You know, we need our future enemies to be very well prepared for the next confrontation in the future.
Might be the Russians the next. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. Who's going to donate an additional $2 trillion in the next 20 years? Huh?
So I thought there was a whole lot of international trading going on. I'll tell you, we were driving through Hindu Kush region of Afghanistan, and we drive through some opium fields and marijuana fields.
Sure. Yep.
Been there.
And again, my brain reverts back to when I was a teenager, when I was making poor choices, right? Like, hey, can we stop? Because I'm Hindu, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And next thing we know, a little single pilot helicopter pops up in the air. The bubble helicopters. Right? From like chips. And so I see it and I hit up the sergeant. I say, hey, sergeant, man, we got this helicopter, man. What do you want to do? He was like, what? And then everybody turns around. I was like, oh, shit. I'm like, yeah. I'm like, what do you guys want to do? And on top of that, can we catch these fields on fire? You know, war on drugs. Like, we are here. Let's do it. Mm-hmm. And 20 minutes go by. Helicopter's hanging out. We're hanging out. They say, you know, the helicopter goes back to his camp, and we end up taking off. And I'm like, what the fuck just happened here? We are in the Mecca of opium. We are now able to fight this war on drugs. People are dying in our country left every single day because of heroin. Mm-hmm. This is where they're getting it from. All we have to do is catch it on fire. We were told not to. Don't do it. That's not your mission.
Mission parameters, man.
And we're like, so this is where my brain starts to get angry with our government. This is where I feel like that I'm not even, I don't even want to be here. Not that I'm a not a patriot, not that I can't stand what happened.
Yeah.
But I can't stand the bullshit that the higher ups are trying to shovel down my way. And I'm like, man, one of these things is not like the other.
Mm-hmm.
And so I couldn't wait to get out of Afghanistan for so many reasons. One, I went 84 days without a shower.
That's pretty good.
Yeah,
it's a pretty good record.
Not too bad. Right?
It's a good personal best.
Yeah, I connected my neck hair to my sideburns. It's the greatest thing ever.
It's perfect. Oh. Chest hair to the,
oh, it's
to
the beard. Oh,
that's perfect.
Woolly. That was a woolly mammoth. So we're in Kandahar International Airport, and now we're there to be perimeter security.
Okay.
When we pull into our spot, we get out, walk the around the vehicle to make sure we're good with landmines. We had rolled over one.
Huh.
Scary. Right. Shit. So again, these landmines had been in Afghanistan since the 70s, late 80s, early 80s. And so that was a benefit, but yet it was also scary because you didn't know. And so fortunately, it didn't go off. So EOD came in, secured that one.
So this is two very close calls within, I mean, four months, five months.
Yeah.
You've had a dysfunctional RPG round as well as a dysfunctional landmine.
That's correct.
That's lucky. I see your relationship with God.
Yeah, it's very real.
Yeah.
People would be like, I don't believe in miracles. I'm like, I don't give a shit. I'm like, God, I believe in them.
Yeah, the four-leaf clover on your hat.
Yeah.
It's a symbol, yeah.
Yeah, it's the luck of the Irish.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Something.
So for whatever reason, they decided to have a group of our scouts go out and start clearing landmines. Because as what anybody does when Marines get bored, they decide to do stupid shit.
Sure.
And they're out there with bayonets stabbing the ground, looking for landmines.
Yeah, this is very familiar with this tactic.
Okay. So I'm not making this shit up, guys. This is real talk. This is next level landmine finding.
You'll find it.
Grab this knife. Poke the ground. Hope it works out. So as with anything, it's left foot,
like
right
that
foot,
detail.
Right.
Well, I mean, they know that metal detectors have been around for at least 100 years at this point, right?
Yeah, for the Army, not for the Marine Corps, yeah. Right?
Which, I mean, you could just go buy one at Walmart.
Yeah, that was a thing in Afghanistan. A lot of their Walmarts were just closed while we were there, so the shopping centers were down.
Maybe don't do the mission if you don't have the equipment.
Yeah.
How about that? You know, just
great suggestion.
Great suggestion.
Great suggestion. Yeah. Bad implementation.
Yeah, because
and so
Walmart,
that's when
Marines
we sustained our first real casualty.
Mm.
So there were six of them. First two guys step on it, nothing happens. Third guy steps on it, landmine detonates, mushroom cloud goes up. The only thing that saved that man's life was the erosion of the ground and the position of the bouncing Betty. Bouncing Betty exploded outward versus up and out.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Those are nasty.
Nasty. They're filled with glass, rocks, nails, you name it. Feces.
And they move up about 4 feet.
Yeah.
Right? They pop up 4 feet and are specifically designed to shred infantry.
That is correct. They will kill, maim, mutilate. They will dismember a person. And so over comms, all we hear is corpsmen up. Right. So that's the call that no corpsman ever really wants to hear, but is excited to get, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's time to get to work.
It's time to go to work. It's time to do our jobs. It's time
that's
to do all that training.
All that training
that they have given us and put it into action.
That's why they're why
and now
there.
It's my damn Marine.
Yeah.
Right? Not, you know, and so I'm hauling ass, not thinking about landmines.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because nothing's been cleared. We've only been in there for a handful of days.
So you got a little bit of tunnel vision being that younger
100%.
Individual.
I'm fired up, adrenaline. I'm pissing fire and vinegar.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm running straight into it. And all you're hearing are these screams and these yells and this chaos and this cloud of devastation. I see one of my Marines with a deer in the headlights, like 1,000-yard stare, right? He's got blood coming out of his ears. He's got 4 missing fingers that he's holding up. And I'm sitting there, Sovereign, right? His name's Sovereign. Where? I said, bro, right over here. He's like, right, just that big.
Yeah.
And I'm like, shit. So we grab him up. I secure him, pass him to the next corpsman to get him to the clinic, and I make my way to where the accident actually happens. And that's where one of the Marines who had sustained a his left leg was blown off.
Uh-huh.
So we secure it, tourniquet, talking to him, Chandler, you good? You good? He's like, I'm ready. Just put me back in. I'm ready, right? It's the most craziest thing that I've ever experienced, to be able to talk to a man with a limb missing, and they're like, put me in the fucking fight.
Yep.
I'm not going home.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, bro, like, you don't understand. He's like, I get it. I was like, all right, we're just going to button you up, and we're going to get you going. And it was me, three other corpsmen,
mm-hmm.
and we ended up getting all of those guys. They get sent to Germany, and really, I just kind of don't hear. There's no report back.
Yeah.
Right?
It never comes back.
It never is.
That just disappeared.
Honestly, and you know that, that's one of the premises of this show, is because you have that separation where you'll most likely never talk to the rescuer.
Yeah. Right.
Or injured personnel. It never happens.
Mm-hmm. I never get to reconnect.
Which I think is a little bit of a shame, you know, but that disassociation is necessary while you're downrange in theater.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
Because you can't be waiting for a report the whole time. So, you know, pros and cons, right? Pros and cons.
Yeah, I had to stay focused as a corpsman.
Mm-hmm.
I had to stay in, you know, in sync with what the mission was.
Yeah.
But in the back of my head, right? Like, how's my guys, right?
Yeah.
My Marines, we're boys,
yeah.
Right? We just... Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what's happening, because I've been in that position, left leg included,
okay.
Is everybody's stealing your shit.
So right on that note,
you know what I'm talking about? It's like, I got back, and when I got back to my unit, they were like, oh, here's everything you had overseas. And I'm like, every single thing is missing.
Yeah. We definitely rat fuck some gear. Because this
which is just harrowing.
Well, like, this particular Marine, he came from 8th and I. Right, he came from the 8th and I, which was like the hoity-toity of the Marine Corps. So this dude was high-speed, low-drag. You know what I mean? Like, just everything was just... He was the epitome of a Marine.
So you have the ACU freaking wallet?
Oh, yeah.
With Velcro?
I guarantee it, man. This guy had 550 cord for days.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just... Yeah. And I...
He just lived and breathed it.
He lived and breathed it. He was the epitome of a Marine, right? Like, he didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
And he was a guy that I admired, right? He had about 5 years on me. And I was just like, wow, man, I wish I had what he had.
Yeah.
And so as time went by, so when we went into Afghanistan, President Bush sent us into Afghanistan without having to ask Congress, without having to declare war.
Mm-hmm.
So the president has the authority to mobilize 10,000 troops without permission, right? A lot of people don't know that. I didn't know that.
It's like the 300 rule.
That's right. So we're just going on a stroll.
Kind of. Yeah. just going on a stroll.
Just going on a little stroll on my knees.
The way that they did it was different, but yeah.
Yeah, same concept.
Yeah.
And so there was a time clock, right? So Congress says, look, you can send them, but they can't stay.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't until, where are we at now? We're at March, April now time frame. So end of November, now we're March, April time frame, and we're making our ways back to the ship.
No, okay.
The last very engagement that we had was with a guy named Johnny Walker. I don't know if that rings a bell. That's the guy
that's the scotch I had last week.
So this was the piece of shit that was the whistleblower.
Okay.
Yeah.
Johnny Walker.
Yeah. Look him up.
Doesn't sound familiar.
So he was the whistleblower on telling us where Obama and, you know what I mean? He was the one feeding Obama or Bin Laden, whatever the dude's name was.
Osama,
not Obama. And that's why I didn't vote for that man either. His name was too close to the guy we were trying to capture. But we don't go down that road either. That's not what this is about. So that was the guy that was out there doing intel for the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Okay.
And it was one of our units that ended up capturing this guy.
Okay.
I also had to do...
There was a code name, Johnny Walker or something?
I believe so.
Oh, okay.
Again, I'm low.
Yeah.
Low level.
I never heard
Everybody was just super stoked. He was in a Connex box. Yeah. Connex box. He was tied up in there, stripped down to his skivvies.
Wow.
They squirted him with water almost every hour on the hour. Like, just some serious hazing shit.
Yeah.
Like, and I was the corpsman.
I mean, that was the beginning, right?
That was just the beginning. But as the corpsman, they were like, hey, according to Geneva, like, we still have to render medical to our enemies.
Yeah.
Which, I was like, such bullshit, right? Like, I have limited medical supplies to begin with.
Yeah.
Now you want me to treat my enemy? So I just made sure he wasn't dying.
Sure.
I mean, airway breathing circulation, ABCs, you're like, you got those? Like, yeah, all right, you're good. Yeah. So we ended up leaving, getting back on the our Navy ships, and we got to go to Sydney and Perth, Australia, came back to the United States. I'm telling you what, in 2002, April, May timeframe of 2002, you could taste freedom in the air. You guys remember?
Absolutely.
That time frame in America.
Absolutely.
Post 9/11 syndrome.
Yeah. You just felt it.
It was unified for sure.
The entire country.
Yeah, there was American flags on every vehicle,
but,
outside every house.
Yeah. I also do love to bring up the point, it's a morbid topic, but the amount of hate for other than your own country was massive during the time, too.
True.
I mean, just beating innocent Muslims on the streets.
Yeah.
And the just
they know that.
Oh,
absolutely. I wasn't privy to any of that.
Oh yeah, there was a lot of
And that's one of the shadows of 9/11 is it really instilled a lot of hate to people who weren't from your own cloth.
Yeah, it wasn't your fault. It wasn't their fault.
Or people who just
you'd have just doctors being beat on the street with their wives and kids just watching
Indian Sikhs, yeah, same thing. Like, They wear turbans all the same, but entirely different religion, entirely different area of the world.
Culture.
And just because they happen to look similar, they were all the same. Yeah.
So I always like to bring that point up because, if there is a future confrontation that we face like that, we really have to be cognizant about who we're putting that energy towards.
Yeah.
Yeah. And paint it in a positive light. There's so many positives that came out of 9/11. In an unfortunate situation, but there was a lot of unfortunate situations that happened because of that as well.
Very true.
And I don't think that I was living my life with blinders.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that I was so involved with the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
With training operations.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Getting worked up to go to Iraq.
Yeah. Put yourself in those shoes as well, too. As I remember as a young, private in the military, my hatred towards the enemy, which
100%.
Which overflowed into, quite honestly, colors of people's skin. Like, it really just gets ingrained in you, this hate, and this is the enemy, and that's all you see. So it took years of being able to expose situations like that where I'm like, that's not the answer.
And if I'm being 100% honest, like, there's still, when I see certain people in my subconscious, like, I'll do a double check.
Yep.
Like, whoa, bro, why'd you leave that backpack there?
Yeah. And that's what I call good training.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm just, my head's on the swivel, man. It's not that I believe that you are, but
one of the tools that you get out of the military is situational awareness. Yeah. And being able to be cognizant of where the exits are is not a detriment to who you are. Maybe if you're putting your seat at a specific location and you're doing all this, like, that's excessive, right? Because when's the last time you've been attacked in an Applebee's, right?
Exactly.
Probably every Saturday night, but...
yeah. But that's Martha.
That's Karen.
That's Karen.
That's right.
Yeah, and I do things subconsciously. Like, I don't even realize I'm doing it until my wife tells me I'm doing it.
Yeah.
They're like, hey, and now she just asked me, Mike, do you want to sit right here? And I was like, you know what? Today, no. I want to sit right here.
And that is actually such a good, powerful thing for taking control of your life again, is do the things that make you uncomfortable, especially if you're struggling with things mentally. Yeah. Hey, I need to sit in this seat. Sit in the opposite seat.
Yeah.
And challenge yourself. Because when you have that victory of no one coming into that Applebee's and shooting it up, you win.
Yeah,
win. And so I have been doing that. Mm. And I guess that started probably about 8 years ago when I decided to, like, quit doing drugs and alcohol, because that was my go-to.
Right.
I
got that opium addiction that you pocketed overseas.
Well, we're not talking about that.
Yeah. So to kind of back it up a little bit, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but you were talking about, like, coming home and, not having any blinders on. And how did that feel when you were back home after the first time of this initial invasion where no one understands, not a single person understands?
Honestly, I felt like a stud. I did, like a real deal. Yeah. I was 20 years old now.
Yeah.
Right?
Take on the world.
Actually, no, I was still I was 20 years old. I felt like I was a stud. I mean, my girlfriend showed up.
Yeah.
Right? I'm like, oh, shit.
He just came home from home.
Like, heroes welcome. Yeah. Right? We fly home together. Mm. I'm talking the Mesquite News was at my house.
Yeah.
Like people there that I hadn't seen in
this
forever.
Was a time where you couldn't even go to a gas station, coffee shop, grocery store in uniform or any sort of identifying marker without people buying.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Paying for your gas, paying for your groceries.
Insane.
I had people pay, like, you know, obviously I have a little bit of a different tattoo, missing a leg, you know, but I'm in shorts and I'm in a grocery store. I would consistently have people. You know, purchase my groceries. And that really resonated with me. It was unsettling at first.
Yes.
Because I'm like, no, I could pay for my own groceries. I work for it. Like, I'm good. Yeah. Until someone sat me down. He was a higher ranking official. And he said, this is not for you. They're doing that for themselves to show the support that they have for this country. Yeah. So you don't represent David Reed anymore.
That's right.
You represent the flag that's on your shoulder.
Yeah.
So once I kind of got that in my mind, I've totally taken that as well with people who thank me for my service as well, is, you know, you don't scoff at it.
Right.
You say thank you back. Thank you for your support. And that's for the entire entire country who dons that uniform.
Yeah. And I do the same. And I'm like, hey, you know what? I appreciate you being a patriot.
Yeah.
Right. And I tell them that. I said, bro, I said, if it wasn't for you, like, I wouldn't be who I am.
Yeah.
I said, we're 1% of this population. And I said, if we didn't get the rest of the support from the remainder of this nation, we would be for nothing.
Yeah, absolutely.
All of this sacrifice would be for zero. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate them to be being a patriot and just, like, you're right. We don't need you to pay for our damn groceries. But it's not the groceries. It's the gratitude that they're just saying, look, man, this is all I got.
It's an act of service.
It's just an act of service.
It needs to be acknowledged.
Yeah,
absolutely.
So to answer your question, man, I felt like a baller.
Yeah,
I felt like a superstar, man.
That's great. And I also, I really love looking at this trend that we see across the board when it comes to individuals who had traumatic childhoods.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, we say all the time on the show, make the best operators.
Mm-hmm.
It is because you're exposed to that kind of tough environment. So
chaos.
Chaos ensues and you're kind of embrace that and you're used to it. And then I'm sure that helped your past has helped with your mental health aspect of coming back from that deployment as well. Can you touch on that?
So I wasn't in the greatest place.
Yeah.
My childhood taught me to, I was allowed to do drugs and alcohol at the age of 12, 13 years old. Right.
Hard drugs or?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I did my first line of cocaine in the eighth grade.
Wow.
Right. Like, so
early.
Yeah. Ridiculous.
It's got to be an experience.
Definitely was. I don't think experience is a big enough word for what I felt. Oh,
yeah. Profound.
Yeah. but I could go on. That's a whole another podcast.
Yeah.
And
drugs are bad.
Yeah, drugs are so bad.
Drugs are bad.
So I was introduced to this lifestyle.
Sure.
Right. It was considered okay. And it wasn't like carte blanche okay. It was just, I have three brothers that were all a year and a half apart. And how is not that my mom and dad were divorced, but how does like a single mom really control four boys?
Yeah, she does.
Yeah, she does not.
Especially when she's working.
Especially when she's putting in 16-hour shifts.
Yeah.
And then the dad is the one who's buying the alcohol.
Mm.
Mm. Like, we got buy-in. Like,
yeah.
We're good.
Yeah.
And so to answer your question, yes, that trauma did help me as a child cope with some of the trauma that I was exposed to, but the way I dealt with childhood trauma was the same way I dealt with right? War trauma.
You just table it for a later time.
Stuff it down with some browns.
Let's put this right here.
Yep.
And then I was so when we got back from Afghanistan, I got worked up so quickly, like within 6 months, I was back in Iraq.
Wow.
Right? So there wasn't a lot of downtime for me to even acknowledge and process what just happened.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a fun story. When my wife came, I took her to Tijuana, Mexico. It was just me and her. We almost ended up in the Tijuana jail. And then I ended up giving them a watch to allow my wife and I back over the border. I get inside my car and I get pulled over by California State Trooper. So they put me in the drunk tank. They left her wherever. And that morning they let me out. She's walking across the street. Again, this is 2001, 2002, right? So cell phones, all that stuff just really wasn't as what it was today. And so it was just a God thing. She'd come walking across. We hop in the car. We drive home. I get a phone call from my senior chief. Hey, Mike, how was your weekend? Like, senior chief was awesome. I'm like, great. Can you might as well leave your car there and fly back to Camp Pendleton? You are now being brought up on charges for underage drinking.
No.
I was like, really, bro? And so they put me in what's called 30 days of CCU, which is a correctional custody unit. So I went through another boot camp. So that was ran by E4s.
That's a torture.
I'm talking big rocks into little rocks, little rocks into sand, sand into bags.
Yeah, dude.
Yeah. But it was weird because I never told any of them that I'd gone to Afghanistan. Like, I knew I messed up. I said, fine, this is my punishment. I'm going to suck it up, do it, and I'm going to get out and do my 30 days.
Yeah.
Except we went to classroom time, and this freaking corporal was talking about an event that I experienced. And he was botching it. And it was when we were in Kandahar Airport, and when like this plane came in and it cracked, the tire blew, and the plane kind of basically had a little mock crash. Mm-hmm. And he was telling it, I was like, well, corporal, I said, with all due respect, you're wrong. And he just lost it on me. He was just, blah, blah. And he goes, how do you know? I said, well, I was there. And right, and the whole entire class just shifts, boom, looks at me, and they're like, what, tell us about it.
Yeah, tell
me. So I ended up telling them my experience over there, and next thing I know, like, I'm the right hand of the first sergeant of the CCU guy. He's like, you are with me, you're not doing this dumb shit no more. And I even told the first sergeant, I was like, look, man, I'm not here for favoritism. I didn't tell y'all that story to get out of the bullshit. I said, I was just correcting your corporal that he's over there spewing bullshit. He's embellishing what's going on.
Sure.
And so I had to go through another modified boot camp. So I've been to boot camp three times for all intents and purposes.
Safe to say you got it down now.
I got it down.
Did the Army run that one? Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised.
No, it was ran by E4s, Marine Corps.
Marine Corps.
E4 MPs.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
So if we fast forward a little bit, October rolls around, I get orders to deploy to Iraq. And that's where I tell my wife at the time, I was like, hey, you got to go. She's like, no, I'm just going to stay here in this apartment in Oceanside. I was like, no, that's not what we're going to do. He's like, no, you got plenty of friends. They'll take care of me. I was like, look, that's the problem. I said, I don't need my friends taking care of you because they're not going to take care of you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't need to hang out with Jody. Okay. And so I was like, look, it's best for you if we just get you home to Texas and you just wait on me to get back.
Yeah. Stay with your parents for a bit kind of thing.
Get the fuck away from these Marines. Right. Because they got one thing on their brains. They ain't helping me. So we make our way into Kuwait, and I was part of the initial shock and awe, right? The big bomb that broke the berm going into Kuwait. So we were part of that initial invasion into Iraq. And so we're considered what's called the tip of the spear because of our vehicles, right? Being able to maneuver through the desert and through that terrain, whereas tanks, that's what they learned in Desert Storm. Tanks are garbage in the desert, right? Tracks just ain't going to cut it. Mm-hmm. And so we became a very valuable resource to this war. And we're just plugging away from Kuwait all the way to Tikrit. This was about a 4.5 month, 5 month stint.
Okay.
That took place, and we probably got engaged maybe 15 times along the way.
Okay. Over 5 months.
Over 5 months.
That's not too bad.
Not too bad on the grand scheme of things when you're at war.
Light and breezy.
Yeah. Right? I love that comment's not too bad.
Not too bad.
Like our listeners are probably like, oh, 15 times.
It's light and breezy, you know?
Yeah.
It's
like, an like easy a, day.
Yeah, it's like
it was no, because it really wasn't. It wasn't that bad. Like on the grand scheme of things, the people in Ramadi was way worse. Al-Azari was way worse, right? Like 2006, 7, and 8 was way, way worse than what I experienced. But we did have some serious issues that we faced. One, dysentery, right? Like our guys were getting sick. We didn't have the supplies.
we were in mop gear for 2-3 months. For folks that, like, both their faces says it all.
Yeah.
Like, oh, don't you ever say that word again around me in my life. So we were awful. We were fucking mop gear forever. Right?
Yeah.
Right?
Which, for those who don't know, is a gas mask and the whole respirator.
NBC.
Yeah.
NBC.
Right? Yeah, it's a big trash bag you're wearing.
Like, I get in a mop.
It is. It's a sauna suit. If you're familiar with those things,
that's it.
Yeah. And fucking boots. Oh my gosh, you can't walk without falling
those
in these
rubber
things.
Boots.
Oh, it's horrible. And so I remember getting into the mop suit at 180 pounds and getting out of the mop suit at 120 pounds.
Yeah, right. Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're experiencing heat casualty. You're experiencing dysentery, right?
So the elements are kicking your ass.
The elements are winning.
Yeah.
And it's like, how do I keep up with limited supplies? Yeah. We're forward. Everybody that's supposed to resupply us is Army. Army can't. Are you guys Army?
I'm Army.
Armies can't pull their head out of their ass. I'm sorry. It's just the fact.
I'm not regular Army, so it's
okay. So you understand, because they probably couldn't supply your ass when you needed it.
Listen, I was in special operations. We got more than enough supplies.
We had too many supplies.
We were in special operations, but not that kind of special. We're like the morons of the group.
You were just in operations.
Yeah, we were just. Don't let the word reconnaissance fool you. We weren't that type of recon. That's force recon. But we did transport a lot of SEAL guys, recon guys, Army Bubbas, because we had to transport.
Sure.
Yeah. And also the snakes that were out there in Iraq, they were also our threat, right? We're living in the middle of the damn desert. Yeah. You got a hot car running, those reptiles were looking for heat. I can't tell how many times we woke up and there were snakes in the boots, or there was something happening, or these freaking ridiculous ass spiders that you had to, are we fighting like these freaking gopher people, we're fighting these reptiles, we're fighting the elements. So there was just an accumulation of shit.
Yeah, and not to mention, there is nothing like an extended amount of time as well. It's like anyone could deal with, you know, going camping for 3 days, not taking a shower, having snakes, all this shit, you know, whatever. But when you add 4 to 5 months on top of that, and it's like, I don't care how you feel, you're getting up at 4 a.m. and we're moving out.
And we're moving.
That's the suck.
Yeah. Oh, dark 30. Like, no, don't ever say that again in my life. Like, nobody ever used those terms to me.
Nope. Yeah.
And
it's funny. I hear all these individuals too. They're like, oh, look at my clock. It's 4:30 in the morning. I'm grinded.
Yeah.
You chose to do that.
Your grind and my grind were different at 4:30.
I could get up at 8 and finish everything by noon.
Why did you do that? I slept until 7.
Still I got to say 8 hours of sleep.
Shit, man. Yeah. Actually, I don't. Like, I did wake up at 4, but not because I wanted to. Yeah. I can't sleep like most people.
Yeah.
I'm waking up for different reasons. What's going on? We're good? We're good? I'm like, all right, I'll go back to sleep. I don't know. So we're in Iraq. And again, majority of our role in the Iraqi invasion was tip of the spear. Get in, push forward, and get as much accomplished so that the Army could come in and start setting up base camps and moving forward appropriately. Yeah. So for those that don't really remember that initial assault, we had the Marines come in from Kuwait. We had an Army regiment come in from the north, and then another Marine Corps regiment come in from like the southeast, from Uzbekistan or Turkey or some shit, right? And so the problem was the comms. Right? Nobody was communicating that the Army was a day away from our paws.
Huh.
Right? So we got a lot of blue on blue issues.
Yeah.
Like, I had one of my Marines get shot by an Army guy. Wow. The only thing that saved his fucking life was penthouse. Like, real talk. Because we, again, no plates. And finally, like, and this was probably one of the worst fire engagements that I was a part of, where it was at probably midnight, 2 o'clock in the morning. And we are firing it one way, and they're firing back at us. And all you hear on the comms is, cease fire, we're blue on blue. And that's when we found out that the Army were a day ahead of what they were supposed to. We were moving faster than what we were supposed to. So we all conveyed at the place early.
Yeah.
But nobody decided to tell anybody.
Yeah.
Right? So the comms, man, I'm sure you ran into that shit. I mean, you read some of Jocko Willick's books. You read some of these other people's books. And that was probably one of our biggest issues during this war,
was comms and nobody talking to each other. Or when they started implementing Iraqis into our units, mm-hmm. we didn't know how to identify them. We didn't know how to trust them.
Sure.
So we didn't really sustain a lot of Marine being injured. Where I was really involved with is with the Iraqi civilians. So meaning at one point in time, I believe we were right in Baghdad. And Saddam Hussein and the Republican Guard had evicted everybody that was in the hospital. So we're there on this pause, looking down, and there's a group of people, and they're walking, right? They got IV pole, they're in like patient gear. And I'm like, hey, Sarge, what's going on?
Yeah.
And they're like, hey, I think the Republican Guard took over that hospital because Geneva Convention says we can't fire hospitals.
Yep.
Hospitals, schools,
churches.
So where do you think the fucking Republican Guard did it?
Yeah.
In places where we can't fight. And just don't get me started on that shit either. And so next thing I know, I'm in the back of my LAV, and I'm eating some chow, and there's a line of people outside. And the Marine comes and like, hey, Doc. I'm like, he's like, are you good? I said, yeah, I'm good. Why, what's up? He goes, man, we got patients. I was like, what's wrong with my guys? They're like, oh, it's not us. I'm like, well, what's up? He's like, well, they were told by their people to come and see you. You were the corpsman. I was like, yeah. And so next thing I know, this man brings his 5-year-old daughter in front of me and shrapnel up and down the body. And so I'm like, my heart's broken.
Sure.
I'm like, wow, this kid can't be more than 7 years old with shrapnel down her body. Mm-hmm. And the dad's crying. This girl's crying. They're speaking Arabic. I have no idea what they're saying, but I can tell context clues. Mm-hmm. They're basically saying, please help, right? And I'm like, hey, here's what we're going to have to do. I'm going to take these tweezers, and I'm going to have to slowly start to remove these pieces of shrapnel from your daughter. And so my interpreter kind of conveys that, and the dad's just holding her kid, and I'm one by one removing these pieces of shards from this child. And he tells me what happened. It was a roadside bombing that caused this accident to happen. And I'm like, at this time, I'm 20 years old, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, this is, I'd never in my wildest dreams would have ever expected me to have to go through this, mm-hmm. right? Like I knew my Marines could get hurt. I knew adults could get hurt, but I never really wanted to swallow the pill that I would be helping children yep. who were the real casualties, mm-hmm. right? Absolutely. Those are the real people that suffer from war. It's not the enemy. It's the people that live there. That's their home. Like we're there fucking their shit up.
Yeah.
And they're the ones who's taken the major hits.
Yep, yep.
And next thing I know, I take care of this little girl. Another couple comes in holding their baby. Baby's lifeless.
Huh.
All you can hear is the mom, save. Like that's the only word I think she knew in English was save, save, save. And so I'm giving mouth-to-mouth resuscitation to this baby. Kid wakes up, cries for a little bit.
What the fuck?
All right, I'm like, oh shit. And then I hand it back to the mom. Baby goes limp again. She goes, save, save. Do it again. Comes back up. The baby's tongue is copper. The eyes are rolling. And I finally had to get to tell the interpreter. I said, hey, man, I need you to tell these people there's nothing more I can do.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I can't. And I'm like, dude, you got to. I said, I can't do this all day.
Yeah.
I'm like, look, like a line of people. And so I hand them their child back. And I'm just like, fuck. Right? There's nothing that they can prepare me for this. Like
yeah.
nothing. I don't care where I came from. I don't care what I've seen. I don't care what I've been exposed to. There is nothing that could have prepared me from having an infant die in my hands.
Mm-hmm.
And that has stuck with me. Like yeah. probably one of the things that stick with me the most.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I'll explain. Like so when my daughter was born, the doctor handed her to me. Wrapped. You know what I mean? Like they do. They swallow the baby. Like it's normal. I don't see my child.
Mm.
I saw this baby.
Mm-hmm.
I shoved the doctor away. I said, no, 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 no. I said, you take that kid. And I didn't say my child. I didn't say anything. I said, you take that fucking kid. And my wife looks at me. She's mad. She's like, what the fuck, Mike? And I don't know if I'm just in this fog,
sure,
Ryan, or this just this, this weird vibe that I'm in. Like, I can't get clarity.
Mm.
I keep having these images come in, but I'm in the delivery room, right? Tons of lights, and I see it all, but all I see is the scenario that I was in, right?
Yeah.
And finally, the doctor hands the baby to my wife, to Rochelle, and I leave. Like, I'm fucking walk out. And I had to go outside, smoke a cigarette, like, and I'm just fucking, like, almost panic mode. And one of the doctors comes out. He's like, hey, man, like, what's up? And I end up apologizing profusely, right? Because I feel like a real jackass that I'm the dad. And I just really just turned my child away, right? I'm like, wow, what a piece of shit, you know, looking back on it. And I kind of explained to the doctor what I was feeling. And he was like, bro, I get it. He's like, he apologized. I was like, dude, you could have never known. I don't share that shit with nobody.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And so it took me a while to warm up to, like, holding my child. And I don't know, it's just a really weird kind of a scenario that I had to go through.
Yeah.
Because of that devastation.
Right.
Yeah. I ended up delivering a baby in Iraq, right? So baby died one day, I delivered another baby the next day. And my Marines are nuts. They're like, bro, you just delivered another terrorist. I was like, what the?
Oh, God, yeah. Sounds like a Marine comment.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, yeah. And so, you know, we fast forward, we get through that, all of those patients, and most of them were just kind of dumb wounds, like cutting their arms and just like wound care, teeth falling out, what have you. But those three events really kind of is what kind of stuck with me.
Sure.
We ended up moving from Baghdad and stopping in between Tikrit and Baghdad. Tikrit is where we assume Saddam Hussein was hanging out at.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up going on to a pause at the fork of the Tigris and Euphrates River. And we're up there. We're just chilling, you know, hurry up and wait. We're waiting. Days go by. We end up becoming friends with some of the locals. They're bringing us food every day. Next thing we know, a mortar round comes at us. And again, they're using archaic weaponry. So the mortar rounds like over here and over there, and they just can't figure it out. I'm like, what the hell? And so we radio it and we get authorization to fire, right? Because we didn't fire until we were pretty much getting hit. And we used 25 mics against humans. That's against the Geneva Convention, right? So they considered that inhumane because they turned into a pink mist. Like, literally, they've fucking disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it was probably, and then the crazy thing is we were all chilling. Okay.
Like Marines do.
Yeah. Like, we were like, whoa, yeah. But, right. Because it's different, I guess, in our brain.
Yeah.
That we weren't committing murder. We were just defending our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And we just won the game. Right. We were like, our brains were programmed like it was a video game. Right. Because that's what it was. And so that old thing happens. They fly it in. They got freaking carpet bombed. Like, and it was almost one of the very first kind of real engagements that the military had into Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And they just opened up, right? They were like, yes, finally the green light to do our job. And they just, it was probably the greatest fireworks show I'd ever seen, but probably a use of power that was just way too much.
Yeah.
But the reason I'm telling you this is because down in the Euphrates River, the Secretary of the Navy, the Secretary of Defense, and a couple of admirals and generals were down there bathing. Okay? So we're up here chilling. They're down here bathing, washing up, because we're all in mop gear still. We finally got the word that we don't have to be full mop gear, gas mask are off, right? We can relax. They come up and they start laying into us. They're like, who authorized this? Who told y'all could fire these weapons? We're bringing every one of y'all up on court martial.
Whoa.
We're like, what the fuck? Like, we're at war, bro. Yeah. Like, we don't understand. It's not registering with me. And we had this British army guy with us. He hops down off the vehicle. He was like, if you want to take anybody to court martial, you can take me. I'll stomp your ass right now. Someone's like, bro, what's can't take the guy like that? Yeah. He's like, I report to the fucking queen. That was the greatest thing. I was like, okay, you are cool. And so they ended up like packing their stuff up and kind of just moseying on down the way. And we ended up pulling out of that pause and making our way into Tikrit. And that's where we were the unit that actually pulled down those statues of Saddam Hussein.
Wow.
So that's those videos cool. of all those statues being pulled down, that was our unit pulling those down.
How cool is that?
That was it. Well, I didn't know the gravity.
Yeah.
Right? We didn't know the gravity. I mean, we were actually just being assholes. Mm-hmm. Right? We were just bored Marines. We're like, see that statue? You're like, yeah, we want to pull it down? Yeah, let's go pull it down. Right? Little did we know that
it resonates through history.
Like, and reporters are out there filming. Like, we had no clue that these British reporters were embedded and these New York Times people were embedded. And like, we just had no idea. We're young. We're stupid kids.
Yeah.
And we're cheering. We're all standing on top of the Saddam Hussein's head and shit. And we ended up becoming famous. got put in Stuff in Maxim magazine for that scene. But for the most part, a lot of our medical casualties was me treating Iraqi civilians and some Republican Guard. We did have an instance where we were in Tikrit hanging out. We were at a road blockage, right? We had some concertina wire out, and in the distance, we had a vehicle that was just hauling ass, right? And we're radioing it in. Hey, and we're flashing at them. Hey, right, doing what we're supposed to do to get these people to stop, and they're not stopping. Like, okay, it's just about to get real.
Yeah.
And they hit the first stint of the concertina wire, wraps around their axles, endos his car. Right? And I'm sitting here watching this, like, the guys, this is real.
Yeah.
And we knew now that we weren't allowed to fire the 25 mic mics. Whatever.
Those are for tanks.
Those are for something different. So we used the 240 Gauss, which is still pretty nasty. And we shred this dude's vehicle. And they end up calling Doc Corman up. Now my brain's like, oh shit, one of my Marines. Get all the way over there. And I'm looking for the injured Marine. And I say, Staff Sergeant, where's my guy? He's like, oh, we're good, Doc. You need to go help those guys in that car. And I'm like, those Republican Guard guys? And he's like, yeah. Geneva Convention says we have to render aid. So I roll over there, and it's pretty graphic. Like, it's, like, gnarly.
Sure.
Round through the, underneath the chin, out the side. Another one went through the armpit and out the neck. Another one's arm was wrapped up inside the steering wheel from the endo end of the vehicle. Mm-hmm. And we're pulling these men out, and, like, it was pretty gnarly. So I grabbed some quick clot. It was actually kind of mad at the same token. If I'm being 100%, I was really pissed off because, like, they were essentially trying to kill us.
Yeah.
Right? And now I'm being the one who's having to render this aid to them. And I'm like, well, I kind of do what I have to do, but I don't have to be 100%, like, nice. Mm-hmm. So I pour quick clot into his face, and he can just see it. He's just, like, you know, like, grimacing and shit. But it ends up saving his life because I'm able to stop the bleeding, clear the airway.
Sure.
And get them evac'd.
Probably the most effective thing for that.
It was, see, to stop the bleeding, right? Because, again, as the corpsman, it's not like traditional triage would be in the civilian world.
Yeah.
Right? If your guts are hanging out, you get treated first. If your guts are hanging out in war, you're last to be treated.
Sorry.
Because rounds down range is what wins. And so that's how I'm treating these people. So we ended up getting those guys gone and off to the races. And I have no idea, again, what happened to these people, but I do have their Republican Guard ID to this day.
Really?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
One of war trophies, right? I mail it to my wife. And she, when I get home, she's like, Mike, why do you have these people's IDs? I was like, don't worry about those.
I'm going to keep those.
Those are mine. And she's like, but why do you have them? And I was like, do you really want to know? And she's like, yeah. So I told her the story. And she's like, you didn't have to tell me.
You were
best. Pretty wondrous. Like, I asked you if you really wanted to know. And she's like, I can't believe you did all of this stuff. And I was like, look, I had no idea that this is that this is what was going to be my path.
That's,
but it is what it is. And
the reality.
And this is the reality and the gravity of war, of what we got to experience. Mm-hmm. And it's not all fun and games.
Yeah.
And but how do you process it once you get out? How do you manage once you get out? And how do you, and what coping skills are we able to develop so that we don't lose our own shit?
So, and too many people fall,
I fell victim.
You fall victim to drugs and alcohol and poor coping mechanisms that do not ultimately help.
No.
They're just a detriment at the end of the day.
They end up hindering your progress of life.
Absolutely.
Yes. And so, I mean, quite an extensive history on yourself and some of the trials and tribulations you've been in. So, you know, for the last question I got for you is what are you doing now?
So today, 20 years later, I run a multi-million dollar roofing and construction company. I like to label myself as a serial entrepreneur. I still have a very large servant heart where I give back to the community. I really try to share my experience, strength, and hope with other veterans that have gotten out of the service or maybe served in the same time frame that I did that may have gotten what I like to call got caught in the devil's playground because I was succumbed to the devil's playground, right? I ended up breaking my tib fib in half when I was stationed at Corpus Christi playing flag football. Right? It's kind of crazy. You go to two different wars, you come home and get injured.
Yeah, that's how it almost makes sense.
Which was God, again, because I was on my way over for a third rodeo.
Okay.
And I just, again, gotten married, child was just born.
Yeah.
And I was like, I didn't want to go. And I didn't believe in the war anymore. Sure. And at that time, George Bush and Obama were changing jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And for the life of me, I couldn't understand why the American people would vote for somebody with the same name as the people we were looking for. Barack Hussein Obama, right? And I'm just like, why isn't this registering with the people?
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, the only thing that registered with the American people was his skin color. They were trying to vote in the first black president, not that he was Muslim or, you know what I mean? Like my brain, and that's when I was like, fuck this, I'm out. Like, I don't know what's going on in this world. There is no weapons of mass destruction. There isn't anything that you guys said that the shit was going to be there. You still haven't found Bin Laden, the fucking dude we were looking for. We found Hussein. Basically, I felt like we were going to finish Daddy Bush's job.
Yeah.
For all intents and purposes, right? We had no business going back to Iraq. What we were looking for was the guy in Pakistan and Afghanistan, right? They were traveling through the mountains of Tora Bora between Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Afghanistan. And that's where I think our primary focus should have stayed. And had been completely left out of Iraq. Iraq had shit on to do with the bombings or the Twin Towers, right? And so that's where I got some of my animosity to the government.
Sure, right, understandable.
I felt like a number, like I was just a pawn.
Yeah,
in the grand scheme, right? If you think about the board game Risk. I just felt like I was disposable, right? And I'm like, fuck that.
Yeah.
I am not disposable. I'm a human. I know what's supposed to go.
Yeah.
So that's when I made the decision to take my honorable discharge and walk away.
Yeah. Yeah.
They were the ones that got me hooked on Tylox, opiates.
Yeah.
Because I knew the guy in pharmacy. Anytime I wanted a refill, here you go.
Yep.
And I'm eating candy. And I'm eating candy. And I'm drinking a half a gallon of freaking vodka a day on top of eating, you know? And so my life was slowly spiraling out of control with nobody over here asking, hey man, are you good?
Yep.
Right? I'm just trucking along thinking, hey, I can handle it. I'm Mike, I can handle it.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up doing 90 days of intensive rehab, almost lost my family, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And by the grace of God, 8 years ago, I got clean and sober. I haven't had a drink it'll be 9 years in May.
Nice.
So you ask, you know, what am I doing today? It's not about the money that is created. It is about me helping create successful, strong-minded individuals so that they can create a legacy so that they can be prosperous for their family.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
It's beautiful.
Well, thanks so much for coming on and sharing today. I'm sure we could speak for another 2 or 3 hours. Might have to have you on again.
Yeah.
But really, thank you for your service and the things you've done for this country.
Yeah, not a problem. And thank you, gentlemen, for allowing me to come in and share a brief moment of my history.
Of course. Yeah, we'll have to have you back on and talk about the continued part. And I'm sure there's a lot of other stories we can fill in. But
yeah, absolutely.
Thank you very much for your time, Mike.
Hey, no worries.
Where can we find you? Social media?
You can find me on all your local social media platforms, docsroofing.net.
Docsroofing.
You can find me there. You just type in Mike Rannigan on social media. Google me.
Excellent.
But if you call me, be ready to put in some damn work.
There it is.
Like, I'm all about action.
There it is.
Love it. Love it.
Well, perfect. Well, thanks a lot, Mike. We really appreciate your time and your service. This has been the Medevac Podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for watching. Please engage with the show. Hit the like button, share it with some friends or family members, and let us know who you want to see, who you want to hear from, and the topics you want us to discuss, because we listen. See you next week.
Until next time. Cool.